Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also very happy to have back once again on the program. Man, we like to call our chef in residence. His name is Doyle Moore. And for a long time now, he's been a regular feature of this program here on the first Wednesday of the month in the 10 o'clock show. And we talk about food and cooking, and we always have a good time concentrating on some particular topic. And we've talked about how different people approach the same dish. We have talked about different regional styles of cooking. And that's really also what we're doing here this morning, because we will be talking about the cooking of New Orleans. And it's a good thing, I think, to be talking about here. You know, it's January now. We're through the holidays, and it's kind of cold, and you're looking for something warm and comforting. And, you know, I was looking for some way to describe the topic, I thought, well, it's the thing about a lot of this food is it's comfort food, but it's not mild-mannered. I mean, it's comfort food with big, bold flavors. And if there's one thing we like, it's big, bold flavors. That's for sure. So we'll talk a little bit about New Orleans cooking. Doyle has maybe some recipes that he can offer. And if people who are listening
Lots
would like to call in, that we'd be really happy to hear from folks. Maybe you have a recipe, or maybe you just have some, you know, cooking story or a food experience with this kind of food that you might want to recommend. And I know one of the things maybe we'll end up talking about here is red beans and rice, and that's something I've been on the lookout for a good recipe for that for a while now, so maybe somebody has something they would like to suggest. Any and all of that is certainly fine. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455. We can also get emails. You can send us your thoughts that way. will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, welcome back.
Yes, thank you.
So what was your introduction to this kind of food? Do you remember, was there something you would say, well, this is the first time I had?
Well, it's always floating around us, and we have a lot of the things that we've eaten. I just sort of grew into it, I guess, and then got to putting other things together. I forget when it was. I think it was sometime in 1972. I wrote a little cookbook on Cajun cooking. So I was audacious then. Is this somebody?
Well,
on the
this is a call.
Let's have a call, and then
okay.
I want to read something.
Because, yes,
as a preamble. So
right.
Let's
well,
talk to somebody.
Well, we will not make the caller wait. This is someone in Champaign, line number one, and we'll go right there. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
A brief comment, if I may.
Sure.
Doyle.
Yes.
Happy birthday.
Well, you know, you're awfully close. Yes, it's January the 9th.
Oh, well, I guess that's happy birthday greetings, January the 9th. That would be Friday.
Yeah.
Friday, how about that? Another Capricorn,
that's it.
So yeah, some people feel that we're a little on the, you know, dull side. Well, you, not you, some of us. But we're reliable, we're solid. We're, you know, we just want to be sure of stuff.
That's
we,
it.
We just want to know where we're going.
Well,
all right. Anyway,
no, I keep on going with that. Yes. Did you have something you wanted to talk about?
No, I think all he wanted to do was say happy birthday.
Oh well, I'm all for that. Well, I asked permission from David to let me read the introduction, because I think the little introduction that I wrote in this book, I think I did it sometime around 1974, and it was for an esoteric a publication called the New Arcadian Journal, and it's full of poems and songs and writings and artwork and various things dealing with the idea of new Arcadia. Since Evangeline was such a great part of the Acadian culture and slipped down to New Orleans, from whence the word Cajun, I wanted to write a little story that sort of gives you an idea of what this mass of food is all about, because it is it's quite unique. So if you'll bear with me, I'll read here as best I can hear for this today. Okay. The distinctive tastes of Cajun cooking are created, developed, and locked into the personal experiences of each individual cook. It's the direct process of using fresh, local, and seasonally available produce that Evangeline and her fellow travelers brought with them on the trek from Nova Scotia to their newfound land we know as Louisiana. The plethora of seafood in the Gulf waters and the availability of fresh water fish, crawfish, and turtles in the various combined with the forest source of deer, squirrel, rabbit, and raccoon. And turkeys, ducks, and geese provided an embarrassment of riches to complement the domestic farm animals that were raised for food. The long growing season, the abundance of native herbs, greens, and fruit gave the goods to complement all that protein. Kindly disposed to paying attention to local manners and customs, the resettled Acadians quickly adopted the practice of the black community, who cooked with okra and peanuts, and from the Choctaw Indians they took a mixture of ground sassafras leaves to make the thickening agent called filet powder. Together with the fiery transplanted fiery hot capsicum pepper from the Caribbean, a repertory of cooking developed with these folks who were complacent to live off the land. Take so you have, and make do with the best, became the prevalent attitude of the Cajun provider. The pleasure of cooking is for both men and women in the family. Which one perfects their own specialties, and woe to anyone who tampers with the recipe. Since produce is made available at specific times of the year, and relying on folkways, superstitions, and customs dictated the appearance of a food at a table. For example, in this Catholic community, you are never to refuse crab gumbo, a food for fast days, and shrimp or oyster gumbo, precise Lenten dishes. As for the proliferation of various of ingredients amounts found in gatherings of Cajun recipes, we might well understand that their brass cooking is the process of ad lib and the innovation of basic reactions in relation to what is available at the moment. And since each person is supposed to know how to cook, you can assume one wouldn't pay any attention to another's recipe anyway. It is said that if you ask 10 Cajun cooks for a recipe, you will receive 15 answers. Perhaps this is nowhere more true than trying to establish a recipe for brown roux, that singularly significant Cajun concoction that appears in so many Louisiana regional dishes. Through the litany of variations, it's long and equaled only by the personal demands of the cook as to the pan's shape and size. I have a recipe and a method that has proven successful and rewarding. In essence, you surround each grain of flour with oil and slowly cook it until the roux is a nut brown and develops a toasted flavor. Using a cast iron skillet or an enamel skillet, put in 1.5 cups of ordinary flour and 1.5 cups of cooking oil. Over moderate heat, using a pancake turner flipped over so you can scrape the bottom of the skillet, stir it, continually stirring this mixture. It takes a long time. And at least 45 minutes to cook the flour to the rich, dark brown roux flavor. Do not let it burn. It will be bitter and useless, and you must start over. When the roux is done, scrape it to a bowl and set it aside until needed. It may be kept for several weeks in the refrigerator. The oil and flour will settle and separate, so when you're ready to use it, stir it all together to recombine it. Making brown roux is a learned and honorable skill and must be practiced. Great pride and care is taken in the preparation, and that responsibility may be entrusted to only one person in the household. I have been met at the door when arriving at an other than the appointed time by the lady of the house holding the skillet and stirring with the admonishment, "I hope you didn't make me ruin my roux." Serious business. In Louisiana, they say, I can't read the French that I wrote down here. Each cook knows his own pot the best. So it's all there, and it's everybody's. And so they all, it's a big conventional way of cooking. And I like that. I think that a lot of people are confused as to the difference between Cajun cooking and Creole cooking. And for the best description I can give is Creole cooking uses tomatoes. And Cajun cooking does not use tomatoes that much, if at all.
Okay.
So you have these sort of rich French-inspired Creole cookings, and then you have these brown things that are made from meats and sauces and long cooking and that sort of thing. So it does exist, but they're both very exciting foods, and they seem to cross back and forth. I mean, everyone's going to say, I will not cook Creole or whatever it is. And so it has made a very rich and distinctive cuisine. And then I'm just curious about it. And so at one time when I was visiting New Orleans, I just took the time to take some lessons in Cajun cooking. And that's how I got started, I guess, in answer to your question.
The man we like to call our chef in residence, Doyle Moore, for a long time, he's been stopping by here first Wednesday of the month talking about cooking. And we've talked about different kinds of dishes and different approaches and different regional styles. And this is certainly one of America's great regional styles of cooking. And it strikes me that, you know, now we have this very, what we think is a very contemporary notion that you could take things from different kinds of cooking and put them together and get something unique. And if there's anything that's fusion cooking, this is it, because it developed by taking all of the, as you say, all of these different influences, African, Native American,
yes,
European,
yes,
and using what people had. So that's why, as you say, there's a lot of seafood and there's game. And taking all the things that people had, which is also, we think, well, that's very now and very happening, you know, using local ingredients. Well, these people there were doing it a long time
ago.
Well,
it was a survival technique. Take so you have, you know.
Yeah.
If you got it, use it.
Yeah.
If you don't have it, don't use it. So things that were made available became a part of the repertory rather than, oh, dear, I wish we had a blah, 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 and then run down to the grocery store and try to find it that was brought in from somewhere. No, everything was people were dependent on being able to be inventive with their food.
Yeah.
It depended on that. And so, but the funny thing about all that is that it became such a serious business. It's very, very serious, you know.
In the way that people think,
yeah,
you know, this is the way you do it.
Exactly.
But of course, you get enough people together, and you'll get a fight because somebody else say, "No, that's not the way you do it. The way I do it is the way that you do it."
Exactly.
Yes. Exactly.
So we have quite a story there.
We have a caller here. By the way, I was looking at last month's calendar when I was talking about your birthday. I misspoke. I think actually your birthday is Monday, isn't it? Next Monday, the 9th?
Right. Oh, the 9th. It's the 9th.
Yeah, okay. I said it was Friday. No, it's not Friday. the 9th in December, the 9th was a Friday, but see, we've still got our December calendar
right
up here on the wall. I'm living in the past. How like me? let's see. Let's talk with somebody. I'll be quiet. Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Hi. I was listening to the distinction between Cajun and Creole.
Yes.
And that's very interesting. I'm also wondering, does that comprise what we consider Louisiana cooking, or is there an additional Louisiana cooking? Or
no, that's the cooking of Louisiana that you would expect, and it gets down there and it divides into these two manners. That doesn't mean that one person cooks only one style. It's just that style is prevalent from this part of the culture, and the other style is prevalent from the other other part of the culture.
I understand. My additional question then is, we have red beans and rice that we, you know, associate with Louisiana.
Yes, indeed.
And we have black-eyed peas and rice.
And black-eyed peas and rice.
My family always used, and they came from Mississippi. So how did that come about?
Well, that's more the black-eyed peas is a very strong Southern influence. Black-eyed peas, you know, you had to have black-eyed peas for New Year's Day dinner.
Yeah.
And I don't know why, but Mother always made black-eyed peas for New Year's Day dinner and didn't say a word about it, but I knew it never went by. Mm-hmm. There was no discussion. It was just there, and you ate it that day.
It was supposed to bring you good luck.
It was supposed to bring you good luck, but she didn't really know what all of that meant, but it was always there. And then we would sort of laugh about it because then after a long period of time, you sort of begin to expect it. And I've tried to hunt up about the use of that. I'm not sure, but I think that the black-eyed peas, I think they really are an African import, along with other things, which would have been used in this country because they are unique. And what did I see? Somebody on one of the programs, I think, was doing some Moroccan cooking. And one of the things that they did was to take black-eyed peas and then soak them for a period of time and then rub the skins off of them and then crush the bean into a mash and then use that mash much as you would make something like falafels. And that was, I think, was a Moroccan bit. I thought, well, I guess the Moroccans must have had black-eyed peas.
Well, that's very interesting. And, you know, I realized that we always had it, of course, every New Year's Day.
Yes,
no
indeed.
One, as you said, no one ever knew why. But and this is why I'm curious. Is, of course, red beans have become so popular, associated with Louisiana cooking, but the black-eyed peas are just sort of still sitting there. I didn't know why.
Red beans and rice is generally a Monday dish.
Okay.
Because Monday was wash day, and so you cook the beans while you're doing the washing. At least my mother did, and she didn't make red beans and rice, but she always cooked beans on wash day, and well, I was 12 years old before I found out that scorched taste in the beans, it always was there. I thought that's what you're supposed to taste, I guess. She always scorched the beans. So even being a wash day meal and such, there was a slightly different taste in the beans that we had that day. She cooked beans at other times, but always on Monday. And red beans and rice generally is a tradition of again, Monday cooking because of wash day.
Well, that's fantastic. Thank you very much.
Yes. Right,
well, thank you. Okay, now here I have the answer to the question why it is you eat black-eyed peas at New Year's. Believe it or not, the tradition of associating eating black-eyed peas with good luck in the new year is a Jewish tradition. And it goes back a very long way. People ate black-eyed peas at Rosh Hashanah in the Old World, and that it came to the United States. Jews came to the United States in the 1700s, and it was a Jewish practice that was apparently adopted by non-Jews around the time of the American Civil War.
Huh.
And that's how it came to be. It's a thing that you had at New Year's, and they are indeed the first place black-eyed peas. You're right that this is an African thing. It says here, according to Wikipedia, the font of all knowledge, that the first place that black-eyed peas were domesticated was probably in West Africa. But that they also, a lot of places in Asia do also grow them. And that there are these references in to having black-eyed peas at Rosh Hashanah going back at least to the year 500. And it's probably something that's a whole lot older than that.
My.
So there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Black-eyed peas.
Everything you wanted to know and then some.
Yeah. And hopefully it's actually accurate. We'll see.
I think so.
Questions welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. This is Focus, and it's our cooking show. We do it the first Wednesday of the month with the man we'd like to call our chef in residence, Doyle Moore. And this time around, we thought, well, maybe let's talk a little bit about one of the most unique, distinctive kinds of American cooking that there is. And that's the cooking
Well, also, a listener called in and asked for it.
Oh, well, okay. By popular demand.
By popular demand.
All right. Let's talk with somebody else. Here's a caller in Savoy. Line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yeah.
You know, you should have had this show on 2 weeks ago because I just went down to New Orleans on the train. And I'll tell you something. Everywhere I went, I seen and, you know, signs or all the restaurants had things called po' boys.
Oh, yes.
What exactly is a po' boy? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
Well, okay. I think I can answer that, except I'm not exactly certain why the name po' boy came, other than it is a large, ample sandwich, and so this sandwich that you're eating would fill you up. I mean, it's not a dainty sandwich. Mm-hmm. Po' boys are, and that is such a tradition for the New Orleans area. There's another sandwich that gets fighting for that the muffaletta, which is a large round loaf of bread that is sliced, and then meats and salads and such things are laid on that. But the po' boy is a piece of a baguette, so it's like a long large hot dog bun, and that can be treated in different ways. A most important po' boy sandwich is the fried oysters. And so all there is a sauce put on the bread, and then there are about four or five fried oysters laid on top of that, and then the other lid closed over it. And you kind of get it open, and you kind of have to then learn how to close it and keep it closed while you try to eat it. And it isn't something you would serve on a plate to somebody and they would sit down and carefully cut it with a knife. You grab it up in your hand, and it's a portable, a very portable food. But there are various kinds of po' boys, and some of them are vegetarian, and some of them are, I think there's some pulled pork po' boy. But whether that's sort of apocryphal information that maybe somebody is standing around wishing they had something to eat, and the guy would make this little sandwich and hand it to whoever it was, probably a kid, and then they would run away with it, and they were it wants to come from that idea of having an immediate food.
Yeah, but is really the only essential thing about it is, first of all, it's the big sandwich, and that it's on a baguette.
Yes,
and then you can pretty much put on it whatever you want to put on it.
Well, the English make a strange sandwich that is much like the muffaletta, but they that one then is put between two pieces of paper and rolled up tight, and then tied with a string, and then put a weight under it. And then we also have a tradition in this country of taking those sandwiches, something like that, and sitting them in the back seat and letting the kids sit on them while you drive to the beach, because the idea of smashing down that bread into the juices that are in there, then it becomes a more integrated piece. It's not just stuff falling out everywhere. So the po' boy that I'm thinking of mostly is the one, especially in New Orleans, is the one with oysters, fried oysters. So again, I think it just is a habit.
Okay.
Other, a good one, however.
Other questions, comments, particularly recipes, if you have something to add, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And also, if you'd like to send us an email, you can do that as well. That's 800 that's I'm completely confused. That's will-talk. That's what that is, willtalk@illinois.edu. And then the toll-free line is whatever it is, 800-222-WILL. Questions are welcome. Well, I'm very confused. So tell me, I want to hear about red beans and rice. I mean, what is your approach to this dish? And is there something that you think is really essential?
Well,
to this?
I just happen to have it right here in front of me from my very own book. The only trouble is when I copied it this morning, I lost a whole line of copy, and so I don't have the amounts that I would want to talk about. But then it's sort of mixed up anyway. It's dried red kidney beans is one of the techniques. Now, of recent years, we have learned to have, were they called black turtle beans or just turtle beans? They come from the Caribbean, and we have and Mexico uses black beans a lot. But I remember there was a time you didn't even know that there was a black bean, and sometimes the black beans were used in that. But one of the traditions is that you use dried red kidney beans. I think you could probably get away by using a can too, and. What it is you, if you're using dried beans, I would prepare them in the quick manner, which is to bring the water to a boil with the beans and let them cook uncovered for 5 minutes, then turn them off and let the beans soak for an hour.
So then that way you don't have to soak them overnight.
Right. Okay. And so then you would go ahead and cook them after that.
And you probably also want to change out that water, though. Don't you?
Yes. You will. You drain it, and then you put new water in it. Then you melt butter in a heavy 4 to 5 quart casserole, and when the foam begins to subside, add a half a cup of scallions, the onions, and the garlic, and stirring it frequently until they're soft and translucent, but not brown. You see, now that's only onions and garlic. That's not the Holy Trinity. So they sneak away from that a bit. Then stir the beans in with their liquid, because you added some liquid. They weren't cooked yet. They were just preparation for you to cook faster. And ham hock and salt and pepper, and bring it to a boil over high heat, and then reduce it to low and simmer it partially covered for about 3 hours until the beans are very soft. Check the pot from time to time, and if the beans seem dry, add up to one more cup of water. Now, there are arguments about, you've got to have hot water. I've never satisfied why, other than I know two or three cultures that in cooking beans, you should actually add boiling water to add, because the cold water does. Folk wisdom says the cold water shocks it and makes the beans hard. And if you put in boiling water to add, you will keep that consistency. I don't know how much of that is folklore and how much of it is practice, and I don't know how much of it is lazy, you know, like, well, do this instead of that and whatever. And then during the last 30 minutes of cooking, mash some of the beans against the side of the pan to form a thick sauce. So what you're getting is a bean stew, and you mash up some of the beans, and that makes some of it thicker. Now, I know that even something like navy beans, I have seen several recipes where you want to crush navy beans, half of them, for exactly the same reason. And then you if you really want to use ham hocks, and we had the ham hocks and garlic and onions and black pepper, and then the rice is cooked separately, and it is used separately. So what you're going to do is have rice in the bottom of the dish, and then the this bean magic poured over it. It's not really a casserole that you cook it all together and it, because then that gets to be jambalaya, something like that. But then they are just poured one over the other, and it's so. I think, no, I don't think I'm wrong. No, I'm not wrong. That is another one of those kinds of recipes that I love to collect because it makes a perfect protein.
Because of the beans and the rice.
It's a grain and a legume. Uh-huh. And I love to find out the sources. Almost every folk culture has a specialty of a legume and a grain, whether it's tacos with beans and corn. The Japanese have a combination. Oh, it's tofu, which is the soybeans and rice. That's one of my very favorites. Is in Japanese sushi making is inari sushi, which is fried. Spiced tofu and then stuffed with a spiced rice. But I laugh because it's called, well, why not? There you are. You've got the perfect protein. So that is one of the sources of red beans and rice. Mm-hmm. And in this case, it's often called red beans and rice, but I do know a lot of people are making it with black beans recently.
We're talking this morning about food. It's the first Wednesday of the month. Our guest is the man we'd like to call our chef in residence, Doyle Moore. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by the Brown Bag Deli in downtown Monticello. Brown Bag Deli offers freshly made casual lunches and dinners, homemade pies by Inge, gourmet foods, and a wacky collection of unique cards and gifts. Brown Bag Deli encourages you to join them in supporting WILL.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, 10 different topics. Tomorrow morning, or let me do first the second hour this morning, in the 11 o'clock hour today, the guest is Jim Newton. He's a journalist, editor-at-large with the Los Angeles Times, and author of a new biography of Dwight Eisenhower that really concentrates on the time that Eisenhower was in the White House. And that's the title, Eisenhower, the White House Years. He makes the argument that Eisenhower was really a much better president, and there was a lot of interest than he is generally regarded to be, and there are a lot of interesting things going on in the world at the time. So we'll talk more about that in hour two. And then tomorrow in the 10 o'clock hour, our guest will be Ed Yonka. He's director of communications and public policy with the ACLU, American Civil Liberties Union of Illinois. And one of the things we'll be talking about is the ACLU's Project on Speech, Privacy, and Technology, which is something that they say is dedicated to protecting and expanding First Amendment freedoms of expression. And particularly now they're working on a number of issues, including political protest, freedom of expression online, privacy of electronic information, and so forth. So we'll have more on that tomorrow in our 10 o'clock hour. We're here weekday mornings, 10 to noon, 10 different topics for you every week. You can find out what we'll be doing in the days ahead by going to our website, which is WILL.illinois.edu. And this morning here, it's our monthly cooking show. Doyle Moore is with us, the man we like to call our chef in residence. And this time around, we're talking about something about the cooking of New Orleans. So maybe you have a question, a story, a recipe to share, any and all of that. Is great. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And let's see, we'll talk with somebody right here, Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to go back to filet, and I know it's in gumbo. I'm wondering,
yes,
other ways it's used, and it's I guess it would be the Native American influence.
Well, that is from the Choctaw Indians. Yes, they took the leaves and then the leaves were dried and ground and made into this powder, and the powder then, the way you use it in a gumbo is that you put it in near the end, and as I recall, some of my friends referred to that as roping. You've got to rope it. And I kind of going, what's that got to do with it? But I think it come. I think it gets stringy and thick. But it was used after the cooking is done, and then this is a matter of thickening it up, and not using flour or other vegetables. But and then of course the sassafras root, or that's sassafras root. I don't know the real story about sassafras, except I know that you can't get it anymore, sassafras root, because, I don't know.
Isn't it actually toxic?
Yeah, I think it is toxic.
Yeah.
And why the root is toxic and the leaves aren't, I can't answer that. But
if I'm still on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a stimulant in sassafras, and I think it's more concentrated in the root, and it's actually can be used as a precursor to make, I think, what used to be called MDA. So I think that might be the other reason why they're restricting it. I'm not sure.
That's,
but
it sounds good to
leads into something else, which maybe is a digression into libations, but this whole idea of tinctures and bitters, peyote, the wrongly named Angostura.
Yes.
I understand in the South that people sort of cook with it as well, or maybe that's not the case, but the idea of having something like that to have a quick dab of ginger, maybe the anti-flatulent of the gentian in bitters, it's in some bitters.
There are a lot of herbs and things that are different. The Mexicans use epazote for that, as a substitute for Beano, and there are ways of cooking things, bitters and such things are generally used as an appetite enhancer. You'll have a little taste of bitters before you have other things to eat. I know that, let's see, I was on a Croatian farm somewhere over near Springfield. When I was last at a Croatian farm,
over near Springfield,
yeah. The father made his own bitters and then served that as a little aperitif at the mealtime.
So what is it exactly? I'm not real clear on what
it's. I think it's a stimulant. The caller referred to some of the things as a stimulant. So it
it does have alcohol.
Oh, there is alcohol in it, but you don't drink enough to get anywhere inebriated. The alcohol is going to be something to suspend the to extract those tastes from whatever it is that you're using. I don't know what Eastern European, it's very much a tradition of bitters in Eastern European cooking, or not cooking, but the business of making a meal. Mm-hmm. And now we use Angostura bitters if you're making a...
is it going to Manhattan?
Manhattan, yeah. And some people put bitters in soups. I've seen a couple of recipes recently where they would use Angostura bitters, and not a lot, but so it's sort of a concoction.
Mm-hmm. I see. Common ingredients in bitters include cassia, gentian, orange peel, quinine. And apparently Angostura, the main thing is gentian, which is, it says it's a bitter herb, and that they're prepared by infusion or distillation using aromatic herbs, as you would say, bark, roots, and or fruit, for their flavor and medicinal properties. So it also seems to be that's the kind of thing that probably has been home brewed in different traditions for a long time and goes back a long way. And it has alcohol. Although, as you say, I think probably it's that's not the primary idea. It's something that you have a little bit of, and either it goes into cocktails or it's something that I guess is supposed to improve your digestion.
Well, I think what it does is it gets you get reactions, and you have various juices coming into use in your body. I think it stimulates certain things in your body, mm-hmm. and then that complements the meal, because it's not a matter of a taste that you're looking for. It's a matter of something to stimulate a new flowing of juices. Maybe it's bile. Maybe it's other things that then complement your digestive system.
Yeah, I guess also a lot of these things were at one time were promoted as patent medicines. Maybe it was just
bitters,
to have a little toke of that.
Snake root bitters.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
We have about 10 minutes left here. Someone has some sort of something to contribute, a question, comment, recipe, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. So now I want to hear the story of your frog hunting exploits as a child. That's what I want to hear about. Tell me about that.
Well,
when your daddy sent you out there for frogs, you and your
My brother and my father... we didn't do it. I think that we did it as a means of supplementing our diet. We're not a big fishing family, but somehow my father and his sister and her family, and so then my family and their family, we would go out to a little camp alongside the river and stay there for a day. I don't know why, other than everyone fished, and we would bring the fishes home. But my job was catching the frogs, and you go out at night, and I was the one that was to hold the flashlight while you flashed the light. Now, we were talking about that. We did not have a gig. I think they just went over and picked them up. And so they had these wiggly, squiggly frogs.
Stunned like a frog in the headlights.
Well, it was a frog in the headlights. But I just happen to have a recipe here for frog legs sauce piquant. 2 dozen large individual frog legs and a teaspoon of ground hot pepper, cayenne, 1/2 teaspoon salt, 1/2 cup vegetable oil, 4 tablespoons of brown roux. So this is going to, that's why you needed to know how to make the roux. Mm-hmm. 1/2 cup of finely chopped onions, 2 tablespoons of green pepper, and 2 tablespoons of celery. So there's the holy trinity of onions, pepper, and celery. Then a 1 can pound of tomatoes, drained and coarsely chopped with all the liquid reserved, and some garlic, and finely chopped scallions, and parsley, and lemons. So when the frogs are frog legs, they are cleaned and dry them with towels, and in a heavy 12-inch skillet, heat 1/4 cup of vegetable oil, and cook it until it's light, and then add 12 of the frog legs to fry them for 4 or 5 minutes, turning them once or twice with tongs or a large metal spatula. You know they're all leggy bones. They're very. They look like Barbie dolls. it made me laugh. That was another story. I remember. I was in the Adirondacks and at a sports bar, and I ordered frog legs. And when they came, I started laughing. And the mother of my host said, "Does that remind you of someone?" And it was. It's just a Barbie doll that you're eating. So, yes, okay. It did. Then add more oil to the skillet to take the frog legs out, and then do the other half. You only do a dozen at a time. Then you add the brown roux to the fat that's in the skillet, and then drop in the onions, green pepper, and celery, and cook that over moderate heat for about 5 minutes or until the vegetables are soft, and then stir in the tomatoes with their liquid and the remaining the garlic and the remaining half teaspoon of salt, and boil for about 5 minutes longer. And when this vegetable sauce mix is thick enough to hold its shape almost solidly in the spoon, return the frog legs and the liquid that has been accumulated around them in the skillet. Stirring and basting the frog legs with the sauce, cook for a minute or two longer to heat the legs through, and then mix the scallions and parsley that's at the very end. And so you would have a nice pungent sauce, and put them on a large platter and eat them with lemon slices. Mm-hmm. That's a frog legs sauce piquant, and that's a new... here's another note at the bottom of my book. Louisiana cooks also use sauce piquant with turtle meat, shrimp, crawfish, fish, or other domestic birds of every kind. So it is a way of making a sauce, and then you add the meat to it, and it's that direct in cooking. It's not something that's tricky. You've got the meat, you're going to prepare it. You've got a sauce, you have to prepare it, and then you put the meat back in the sauce, and you're done. Frog legs.
Mm-hmm. So what do frog legs taste like?
Well, they don't taste like chicken.
That's what I was looking for.
I know you were.
They don't taste like chicken.
I know you were, but frog legs don't taste like chicken. Now, we used to get frog legs here at that Chinese restaurant that was out by Schnucks. You'd get frog legs there. And they were stir-fried. And it is as mild as chicken, but there's not a gamey flavor. They don't have a gamey flavor. They don't have a distinctive flavor, but they have a very nice texture.
Mm-hmm.
because some of the muscle meats, and in the 10th grade we had to dissect frogs, and so I learned all the names of the muscles. The triceps extensor femoris, and those are the parts of the frog leg.
It stuck with you.
It stuck with me. So not only when I was 4 years old were we gigging frogs, but I was learning how to name the muscles in the 10th grade then. I tell you, I've been around a long time.
Couple of minutes left here with this man we like to call our chef in residence, Doyle Moore, who's got a few good stories. The man has some good stories. And we talk with him about cooking once a month on the show, and we always have a lot of fun. And this time around, the thought was, well, like we talked a little bit about the cooking of New Orleans. And this is something that he's been interested in for a while. And these recipes, I think it's really striking. And the little bit he read at the beginning and some of the recipes that he've given come from this little cookbook that you said you made up. This was in the early 70s?
I think it was in the early 70s, and it was published in England as a little esoteric. Mine is just a portion of a larger book that is full of music and stories and poems and drawings and such things. And my friend, who was an editor of the book, said, well, gee, we need maybe something like Cajun cooking. So I put this together and wrote these little bits and added it to it, and it was published. There it was. I don't think you can get a copy of it now anymore. I Xeroxed it because I was asked for it.
Do you know, for a while it seemed like there was this enormous, speaking of cooking in New Orleans, there was this enormous vogue for blackening things.
Yes, that seems to have been pushed more by Paul Prudhomme.
Yeah.
And I don't know if he invented that or not. The blacken, you are what that is a lot of powdered chilies. Chili powders and mixes, and then you cook it in a skillet with no fat, And so you are really burning the chilies, but they then become a part of the fragrance that goes into the fish. There's fish, and other things are blackened too.
It's kind of a very extreme sear.
Yes.
With this highly flavored rub that goes on the outside, and I don't know what I was kind of wondering what you thought about, because I think that some people at the time said, "Oh, this isn't real. This isn't a real thing, and you know, why is it you really would want to burn something like that? Is that really so great?"
No, because that's they're the people also who would be too intimidated to roast peppers over a fire and burn them, you know, because that's you have to cook a pepper over an open flame, and you burn it until the skins are charred and want to fall off, and then you pop them into a bag and let them steam, and then the skins fall off very easy. There are a whole lot of people who don't believe that that's what you're supposed to do, and in the rest of the world, that's what you're supposed to do. So I think it probably came from that weird idea of you're spoiling or destroying whatever it is. Mm-hmm. But I believe what it does is it probably caramelizes in a way, and without so much a use of fat and such things to help with caramelizing. So it would be like highly roasted peppers that you would get. You put on whatever is black and red fish until we ate all the red fish.
Until we ate all the red fish. I think that was the other thing that people said. Paul Prudhomme was responsible for the virtual extinction of the red fish.
That's right.
Because he made black and red fish
black
so
and red
popular.
Fish was the first thing.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're just about the point here we're going to have to say goodbye for this time around. And is a little last thought that you'd like to leave with folks?
Well, let's see. What is it? Laissez bon temps rouler.
Let the good times roll.
Let the good times roll.
I was thinking to myself, you know, it's not good. How long is it till Mardi Gras? It's probably not that well. Maybe it's a couple months.
Well, it's not too far
from
that.
It's not too far away.
Right. I'm making a shrimp Creole soup for supper tomorrow night. That's going to be awfully good.
Sounds pretty good to me. Well, this is the man we like to call our chef in residence. His name is Doyle Moore. It's one of our great traditions here on the program that he's here first Wednesday of the month, 10 o'clock. We talk about cooking, and we always have a good time. Will we see you next month?
Yes. What day is it?
What day is it? I don't have my 2012 calendar. Well, I couldn't tell you. We'll figure it out.
It'll be the first Wednesday.
All right. It'll be the first Wednesday. And thanks very much for being here.
Well, thank you for letting me be here.